Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals is provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information.
The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host.
All right, welcome back to the Cribsiders. I have our producer, Sydney Engel, here. Say hi.
Hello.
Our guest tonight is Dr. Ha Wen to discuss caregiver hesitancy about newborn interventions. But first, Sydney, how about you remind us what this show is all about?
We are the pediatric medicine podcast. We interview leading experts in the fields to bring clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answer lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine. We have a fantastic conversation tonight with our guest, Dr. Ha Wen. Dr. Wen is a hospitalist and clinical assistant professor from Stanford School of Medicine and John Muir Medical Center in Walnut Creek, California. She specializes in newborn care, has collaborated with leading experts in research regarding vaccine and intervention hesitancy, and has developed workshops to help pediatricians improve their approaches to family counseling. When she's not counseling families and swaddling babies, you can find her negotiating with a rambunctious toddler at home or deep in the mountains on a backcountry trail, toddler in tow. She teaches us how to set the stage and her recipe for a successful conversation with hesitant parents, and also reviews responses to the most common reasons for vaccine and intervention refusal.
Our listeners today are going to love this episode. They should not be hesitant in moving forward or listening. I sort of screwed that up, didn't I? All right, guys, just go listen to it.
Hi, Dr. Wen. Thank you so much for coming on the show. First, because we're an informal group, I'd like to ask if it's okay to call you by your first name, Ha.
Absolutely.
Awesome. So we like to start with some rapid-fire questions to get to know our guests a little better. To start, can you give us a one-liner to describe yourself?
Yeah, so I'm a peds hospitalist, but I work with newborns a lot. I am a Texas native, born and raised in Houston, but I live in California now, mostly because I love being in the mountains. I have a toddler. I took her on her first hike when she was just 1 month old, and to date, that's still one of my favorite memories. I've got a soft spot for working with babies, and I'm excited to talk to you guys today.
Fantastic. So I guess, you know, let's do some warm-up questions. So usually my favorite question is, what is your favorite failure, and what did you learn from it?
Oh, okay. So this is quite relevant to what we're going to talk about today. I remember counseling a mom who said no to all the newborn meds my first year of being an attending, working in the nursery. And I was fresh out of residency. I felt like I had this wealth of information and I was so book smart. So I'm going to give this mom all the facts and she's going to make the right choice for her baby. I gave her all these statistics. I think at one point I even printed out a journal article for her. And the whole time she was telling me, you are so right. You are right. You know what? You're right. And at the end of the encounter, she said, you know, I'm going to think about this. Thank you. And I was so confident that I had changed her mind. Like, surely this was a slam dunk. And then I went back to around a few days later. And of course, I find out that she said no to everything. And I was so confused. And it took me a really long time to figure out what had happened. And looking back, I think this was an absolute masterclass on what you should not do when it comes to counseling and about how much I had missed the mark on understanding her reason for saying no and being hesitant and not building a connection with her. Like, that would have been so much more effective. So we'll get into all of that, but I still remember just how sure I was and how confident I was that day. So it is one of my favorite lessons, we'll say.
Oh, that's a fantastic one. I think all of us who have practiced medicine, even for a short amount of time, have experience. And I think especially early in our careers, when we know all the facts and we're so sure of things, then we feel like we can just overwhelm the patient with facts and think that, yes, we can just, like, if I bombard them with enough or use enough like lingo and things like that, that I can convince them that I'm really smart and I should do, but then not get down to the root cause of why they're saying no. And sometimes also then realizing that you may never be able to get to root cause, but at least you tried your best, I think.
Yeah. It's definitely a lesson in humility too. Yes. And connecting with your patients and not just talking at them.
Absolutely.
It's so relatable. I think we've all been there in something very similar, but I think you expressed it really eloquently, just that experience of feeling so confident that we have the knowledge to, if you just share enough knowledge. On a different note, can you share maybe a book or a TV show or a piece of pop culture that you've enjoyed in the last, let's say, I don't know, year, 2 years?
Ooh, okay. I read a book maybe a little over a year ago that was called The Comfort Crisis, a guy named Michael Easter. And it's a piece of nonfiction. It follows this journalist. Michael Easter writes this book after he embarks on a 33-day, really intense Alaskan backcountry expedition. And he is trying to look within himself and decipher the recipe to happiness. And the way he does this is through the book. He walks you through all these amazing people that he meets, but also all of this research that has been done so far on the impact of physical modern comforts on our perception of happiness. It's a great lesson on how we can stand to be a little less comfortable and as a result become a lot happier. Or happiness through lowered expectations is the simplest way to put it, but that's for a whole other podcast.
An episode on happiness might be interesting. But maybe more, it's larger than PEDS, so, but that's pretty cool. I feel like this would be a book that Justin's already read, who is not with us, but I'm sure he could have
enlightened us. It's a great one. I recommend it for everybody. If nothing else, to make you a little bit more comfortable with the simpler things in life.
Fantastic. That's a great one to suggest. So I got to check that out.
Hey, Creepsiders listeners. Easy Resus is your ultimate support to take care of your sickest patients during resuscitation. Whether you are taking care of a newborn during a precipitous delivery, a septic child needing endotracheal intubation, or a seizing teenager, this offline app has drug dosing, equipment size calculation, treatment algorithms, all available in under 3 clicks. This gives you rapid access to life-saving critical info in a user-friendly interface, taking care of the logistics of resuscitation so you can take care of what really matters most. That's your patient. So for those who do not work with critically ill patients, that's okay. The app also has calculated doses of the most used PO medications, including antibiotics and analgesia. Although you can find critical first steps for basic and advanced life support, which could be useful for anyone anywhere. Finally, for those who also work with adults, there is a complete adult section with the same features as in pediatrics. So Easy Resus has drug dosing, the treatment algorithms, and equipment size dynamically calculated based on certain patient characteristics. It also has multiple alerts and content adjusted to age and weight to ensure safety. So someday you'll need to act outside your comfort zone, and with Easy Resus, you'll be absolutely ready. And for Cribsiders listeners, Easy Resus is offering you a deal. Listeners of the podcast get access to 2-month free trial with access to 100% of the app features. So here's how you do it. You download the Easy Resus app, that's spelled E-Z-R-E-S-U-S, on the App Store or Google Play Store. Create your account, then use the promo code Cribsiders. That's code Cribsiders on the Easy Resus app. And for more information, you can visit easyresus.com/Cribsiders.
Sydney, should we get into it?
Yeah, I think we've got a really exciting episode to jump into, so let's go for it. So let's get started with a case from Cashlack Children's. In this case, we are seeing Clara. Clara is a 25-year-old G1 P0 mother who is here for a scheduled induction of labor at 39 weeks. Her pregnancy has been uncomplicated, and she had regular prenatal care with normal labs, including negative hepatitis B, HIV, and syphilis testing. The nurses called you, the pediatric hospitalist, because during the intake process, Clara has shared that she would like to decline the Hep B vaccine and also the vitamin K injection for her newborn. You have been asked to counsel her. So why don't you start us off by just telling us a little bit about this issue in general? Why is this issue so important to this patient and so important to us as pediatricians?
So as pediatricians, we all know the importance of vitamin K when it comes to preventing serious bleeds, and we know the importance of all of our childhood vaccinations. The problem is, despite very definitive evidence about the effectiveness of vitamin K and vaccines, the rates of refusal or parental hesitancy are still increasing. This hesitancy regarding the newborn medications in particular has been associated with a lot of later hesitancy with other childhood vaccines. So this is where it starts. So I thought this would be a good opportunity for us to make a difference. Pediatricians are often the very first healthcare team members consulted to provide counseling for families who are hesitant, and we should be well-informed and better equipped to do this.
Is this a common occurrence that you encounter as a pediatric hospitalist?
Yes, absolutely. You know, when you look at the big numbers, there's a huge range depending on where the studies come from. But the data on vitamin K says that around 3%, or there's a rate of a refusal of about 3% in U.S. hospitals. But it goes way up with home births. It's close to 15%, and then up even higher for babies born at birthing centers. That's 31%. So this is no small number. And for the hepatitis B vaccine, it's also really concerning. There's a big study done between 2010 and 2017 that showed 36% of newborns didn't receive that initial birth dose before leaving the hospital. So this is a big problem.
And you mentioned that the rate has been increasing. Do you have a sense of like at what rate it's increasing and also what factors might be contributing to that?
I don't have exact statistics on how much that incidence has increased over the past few years, but I can say from personal experience that I've been consulted on a lot more in the past couple of years than I did when I first started during training. And there's probably a lot of factors that contribute to this. There's perhaps an element of general distrust with medicines and intervention in general. We'll get into the most common reasons why people specifically turn down vitamin K. A lot of it has to do with preferring a more perceived natural approach or being less interventionalist. I think that's definitely a big trend. And I think there was a lot of also differing data coming out during that entire COVID period where people started questioning a lot of intervention. And we definitely saw a spike of consults come after that.
Now, you're sort of explaining how we see these certain populations you've already brought up to have hesitancy or mistrust of the medical system. We definitely have many other populations have traditionally had mistrust of the medical systems, and a lot of our patients where there may be health equity or social determinants that are at play here. Do we see these populations also affected or have hesitancy in these areas?
So the common associations that I talked about before are primarily what we found for refusals for both vitamin K and hepatitis B. However, we know that health equity is such a big concern. And one of the things that we worry about a lot is just how much counseling families are likely to get on vitamin K. What's their understanding of risk? And then how do we address those things? And there's a lot of data coming out that says, you know, parents believe that they're well informed, but then when you actually ask them, well, do you know about like brain bleeds? And do you know that this could actually lead to something life threatening, just not something like a minor GI bleed? They don't necessarily know those things. And I am almost certain that families who aren't primarily English speaking are probably not getting as in-depth of a discussion with their healthcare provider about these medications when they're first introduced about their newborn baby.
So I definitely want to jump into all of these factors that you're discussing with vitamin K. And I think this will have the opportunity to go into both of these interventions and how to approach them differently and similarly. But maybe before we dive into this, can you just kind of talk about when and how you're doing these conversations? Is there like a right and a wrong way to start it? And what can we do to increase our chances of success from the moment we walk in the room?
Yeah, that's the short answer to is there a right and a wrong way? Yes, I think there's plenty of ways, and I think I've discovered that personally on the wrong ways to open these conversations. And part of the problem is that we're often starting behind the eight ball to begin with. This conversation has to take place as soon as possible because we're talking about an intervention or a medication, a vaccination for their newborn baby within the first hour of life, right? So a decision has to typically be made even before they're born. And there was a survey done of 54 parents who ultimately turned down vitamin K. And according to those survey results, the parents stated they made their decision well before delivery. And then attempts to change their minds were only successful overall in 11% of the time when we work with families who are initially hesitant. So we're starting behind. I think establishing an early multidisciplinary approach during the prenatal period is more likely to result in higher success rates. And that means, you know, if you're the pediatrician who takes care of the older children, this is an opportunity to start introducing that conversation to moms who are expecting, or teaming up with the obstetricians or the midwives would also be really helpful to start this conversation and open up that opportunity and that window to change their minds much earlier. I don't believe any particular approach is going to ever be 100% effective, but I do think some approaches are generally more successful. A common one that has a lot of really good data is using a presumptive versus a participatory approach. Now, the presumptive approach is where you say, Susie's due for her shots today, and you presume agreement from the family. Whereas in the participatory approach, you're asking, how do you feel about these vaccines? Now, if you had to guess, which one do you think works out better?
I mean, based on your prior anecdote, I would say participatory, but I also worry that by approaching it in that way, you're introducing it as there's a modicum of doubt there.
Yes, yes, absolutely. So the data say that the presumptive approach is more effective and has resulted in higher rates of opting in for vaccines and for vitamin K injection. And that's been pretty well studied. It turns out when we confidently tell patients our recommendations, we normalize it, we make it clear that this is the standard of care, they're more likely to go with it. And I think everybody's naturally great at using this approach when it comes to something else like car seats. You know, no, everybody on the day of discharge in the nursery asks, okay, where's the car seat? Do you have a car seat ready for your baby? Nobody asks, well, how do you feel about car seats? You know, they're really unwieldy and they can get in the... It offers no window for parents to suggest that, okay, we can deviate from the standard of care and it's acceptable. We can get into a lot of other general counseling strategies later, but I think this is a good starting point about how we can just better frame the issue from the start by making sure that it's understood that this is normal, the standard of care and recommended by the pediatrician. But I'm happy to talk about other strategies as we go along too.
Hey, Cribsiders listeners, let's talk some more about Freed. Freed is an AI scribe that listens, transcribes, and writes medical documentation for you. So here's the backstory. Gabby, a family medicine physician, and Erez, a computer engineer, came up with Freed, a solution that could help alleviate the daily burden of overworked clinicians everywhere. And for Erez, selfishly, it could mean that he would spend more time with Gabby, who was spending nights, weekends, and holidays updating medical documentation. So what does Freed do? Freed turns clinicians' daily workflow into accurate documentation instantly. There's no training time, no onboarding, no extra mental burden. All the magic happens in just a few clicks, so clinicians can spend less energy on charting and more time on what they do best. Today, more than 4,000 clinicians and their spouses have fallen in love with Freed. So Freed is this AI scribe that makes charting go away, doing your soap notes for you. It is HIPAA compliant, takes 30 seconds to learn, and costs only $99 per month. But you can try Freed for free right now by going to freed.ai. That's freed.ai. And listeners of Cribsiders can use code CRIB50 for $50 off their first month.
Should we just jump into talking about vitamin K now?
Yeah.
So actually, the way I want to start this is as an experienced pediatrician, we all have developed scripts in our mind. You know, how to introduce a topic, and we've said it so many times as sort of just the introductory way to sort of set the stage to ask questions and have this dialogue with our parents. Can you give us an example of what your vitamin K script is?
Yeah, so I actually, it's pretty tailored to the family, but if I had to tell you my recipe that I'll...
Please.
Yeah. I actually never start with asking them or telling them I've been consulted to talk about these newborn meds for you or vitamin K for you. I usually go in and just tell them, "Hi, I'm the pediatrician. I want to talk to you about goals of care for your baby." And I usually try to have a goal that the family shares with me. Like if mom says she wants to exclusively breastfed, sometimes she'll tell me she had a really difficult journey with her firstborn, and then here we are with round two and she wants to do better. So I actually spend quite a bit of time talking to her about that and not about vitamin K at all. And this is all because that's what's important to her. Like she's telling me what her biggest goals are in the nursery. And then I am telling her, how can I support you in this? And we talk about that and make it very clear, like we are aligned, we're on the same team, we are working together because this is what's important to you and your baby. And then we get into, okay, and here's all the other routine stuff that I expect for your baby, because these are the recommended things that we're going to do to make sure that your baby stays healthy and safe. I tell them about that we give the erythromycin ointment, the hepatitis B vaccine, and the vitamin K injection. And then I ask her, if you're hesitant about any of these, I'm happy to listen and talk to you about why they're important. And then we have to listen and hear what they have to say and talk about what their root causes for hesitancy are. And sometimes that requires reading between the lines. I think some families walk in quite defensive and may not actually share their biggest reasons. They'll just say, oh, I'm just going to do it later. Or I'm just not sure about the ingredients. But there's clearly some other reasons underneath. And it requires a little bit more digging sometimes and a longer conversation. I know this is difficult for a lot of hospitalists that are so busy, but I think building that connection and showing a family member that you're on the same team makes the biggest difference when counseling them on difficult topics like this.
I love the way that you both use that approach to create a norm of it, but also introduce a space for hesitance in a way that still makes clear what your recommendation is. I feel like that's a really hard bridge to do. And I love the phrasing you just used there.
Yeah, I think it's so important for us to approach this without judgment of the family too. They can feel it. Like even if you don't say it, I think family members can absolutely tell when you're coming in thinking, oh my gosh, you are so like out of line for this, or you're so wrong. A lot of families have very legitimate worries for their baby that can sometimes be corrected by medical information, but other times it's just their lived experience. I think all of us at one point have probably had a negative experience or a negative encounter in a healthcare setting. And that's real. And I think a lot of families feel dismissed when a doctor just comes in to give some facts and then walk away. So a large part of this counseling approach, and I think what makes good counseling, is really listening to families and hearing them out first. It's important for us to know the facts, but to also listen.
So say you have a mother who declines vitamin K. You know, how do you approach that next? And how do you explain to them why it's, or even they say, oh, can I wait later? Is this something we can do like a month from now? Like what do you answer to the parents?
Yeah. Then? So it very much depends on her specific reasons. So the first thing is asking her, so why? And at first, if her reason truly is that she can just wait a month, then we can talk about why that's not the safest option and the healthiest option for her baby. And, you know, first you can also praise her for thinking about getting it later, because there's clearly a concern there. You know, that means you've heard about vitamin K and you think there's a place for it. Tell me what you're worried about. She'll say, well, I heard it's good at preventing bleeds. Like, you're absolutely right. So you're validating as much as you can when you talk to her. And you say, well, what have you heard? I would ask her, well, what have you heard about these bleeds? And she'll say, yeah, I heard they can happen maybe weeks later. That's why I'll give it to them weeks later. And I tell her, you're absolutely right. So those things can absolutely happen. And I'm really glad that you've thought this out and have clearly done a lot of reading and thinking about this. Is it okay if I share with you some more information to help you with that decision? And then I tell her, we give vitamin K as soon as we can on the first day of life, because that's what decreases the risk of late bleeds that can show up with no symptoms and catch you by surprise. And waiting to give vitamin K later is really risky. And we can have that discussion further and giving her more specific facts about the prevention of late bleeds. But again, it's about finding that common goal and finding out where you align with her We both want to prevent a bleed. We both see the role of vitamin K. Now it's just down to finding out where it fits for her baby and then empowering her to make that choice. With every single family I've counseled on this, I make sure to let them know that they're the ones making the decisions for their baby every single day. And this is one of the first ones that they'll be making. So my job is to help guide them through some of the more difficult decisions where they may not have all the information to start, but we're here to help them.
I hear so much motivational interviewing in that, and I love it. It's fantastic. I'm feeling inspired, honestly, of like, okay, I can go in and have these conversations better than I am now.
I'm glad. Yes, there's definitely a lot of components of motivational interviewing here. And we know that that's more effective than coming in guns blazing, trying to get somebody to change their mind with just more information.
What if we did some scenario, some role playing, mixing it up from our usual approach, and Chris and I each, you know, throw you some scenarios of what Clara says when you say, okay, tell me more about why you don't want to do this.
Sure. Yeah.
All right. So Clara says that she's worried that the injection is going to cause her baby pain. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I know it's really hard to watch a baby have to go through any kind of pain, especially when they're so little. I remember that for my own baby girl too, when she was first born and had to get her shots, she would cry. And that was really hard for me. So I get it. I totally get no parent wants to see that. However, this is probably not going to be the first time that you are going to have to make a hard decision for your baby for their best interest. In fact, I was probably at that delivery, and I had to make that baby cry within the first couple of seconds of life. And that was really important, but I didn't like to do it. But it was important to clear that fluid from their lungs. And that's part of what being a healthy baby goes through in the first few minutes. So sometimes that pain is really, really essential to preventing a greater harm later. And that pain is singular. It's a single shot that most babies do end up tolerating pretty well. We've noticed that we can do a few things that we've noticed seem to help. One is giving the injection when the baby's skin can be skin to skin with you, or even latching. Some babies, they don't even seem to react very much to the injection if we do a few of those things. So we can definitely help you with that and get baby skin to skin when we do all of the baby meds. And then just to keep in mind, I know the injection is hard, but if your baby should suffer from a bleed or another serious consequence of missing out on the vitamin K, then all the medical attention they're going to need to treat that is going to be a lot more invasive than this one-time injection of an extra vitamin that can prevent all of that. So this is an opportunity for you to do something really small that can make a really big difference for your baby later.
Now, what if Claire asks, like, why can't you just give it, like, orally? You know, don't we all take vitamins by mouth? And how does that work? And how does even vitamin K even stop bleeding anyways?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, so that's a lot of really good questions. Okay. Let's start with what we know about vitamin K, or how I would explain this to Clara. So vitamin K is something that we all walk around with, getting enough usually through our diet. And it's a really important vitamin because there are vitamin K dependent clotting factors to help prevent. The problem is when you're born, you don't necessarily have a great supply. It's stored very poorly and passed very poorly through the placenta. When you're a newborn, you just don't have much to start with. And then it doesn't pass through breast milk very easily either. And then even if you gave a baby oral vitamin K, their gut is so immature that it doesn't absorb it very well. The bioflora there is so immature that that takes time to develop. There's been a lot of discussion about oral vitamin K. What we have noticed about it is that there are some good studies. One big one that came out in early 2000s looked from the UK. It looked at a little under 200,000 babies who were getting a variable oral regimen of vitamin K. And that seemed actually pretty effective in preventing what we call earlier classical bleeds that can affect a baby in the first week of life. But it wasn't effective at all in preventing late bleeds. So some follow-up studies still don't definitively show any benefit for late bleeds. There is some brand new data coming out, and this is less for Clara, this is more for us, but there's some emerging data that looks at some specific proteins seen in vitamin K stores. There's specifically one called PIVCA2, and low PIVCA2 is associated with pretty good vitamin K stores. That's what they're seeing on a micro level. And they looked at what would happen to the PIVCA2 levels in the first few weeks of life, at 1 month and at 3 months. It actually showed that patients who received a variable oral regimen, usually it was multiple doses, had low PIVCA2 levels at the 3 month marks, which suggests decent vitamin K stores then. However, the problem with this is that there's no clinical outcome data related to this at all. This is all micro. This tells us that, yeah, there's this lower protein level, but we don't actually have anything to support its ability to prevent late bleeds as well as a single IM injection of oral vitamin K. What we do know, and what I will share with Clara, is that nobody can agree on what that oral regimen should be. It's not FDA approved at all. So even if we tried to order it for her or somebody else does, there's no agreement on what will work. And the volumes are much higher than that of the IM vitamin K injection typically. And the funny part is sometimes when it's ordered orally, some pharmacies, their version of oral vitamin K is just the IM formulation, just given orally. So you're actually just getting more of the IM vitamin K than you would if you said yes to the single injection at birth. The AAP doesn't have a policy statement on the use of oral vitamin K at all yet, and that may change as we get more data in the future. But everybody right now sees how effective IM vitamin K is at preventing bleeds. And for those of you that don't know, most of us know the incidence, but in case you don't, bleeds for babies can happen upwards of 1,700 per 100,000 babies. A single dose of IM vitamin K has virtually eliminated that, and the incidence is less than one now. Another easy factoid you can sort of pocket for your counseling with families is that a baby that doesn't get their vitamin K is 81 times more likely to suffer from a late bleed. And those late bleeds are the scary ones. Those are the ones that come up later. There's sometimes no symptoms at all. More than half of them result in a brain bleed. And then of those patients, a quarter will die. And then more than half of the survivors will have some pretty serious neurological deficits. Those are the facts that I do bring to the table sometimes when parents say they think that it's just, okay, minor bleed, low risk. A lot of families, it turns out, think they understand the risks. There was another study that surveyed a lot of families that refuse vitamin K, and over 80% of them said that they understood the risks. But then when you flesh that out a little bit more and ask them, well, did you know it could cause a brain bleed? Only 20% of them said yes. And then I think less than 10% of them said that they understood that death was a risk. So these are facts that I think fill in a really important piece of the puzzle here. And if families knew how serious that was, I think it would make an impact on their decision-making process for them.
So important to have some of those facts in your pocket, and also be able to have the mom or parents teach back what they got out of the conversation. I think that's so they're actually making an educated decision.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to throw one more scenario. I think you addressed, I think one of the other maybe reasons for refusal that you addressed within that one was whether the baby could get enough vitamin K through breastfeeding. And I think I heard you say that it just isn't passed through very much. Is that correct?
Yeah. And I try to tell them that, you know, this is, first of all, I think that's a really commendable goal if you're going to try to breastfeed your baby, and that's wonderful. So I usually start the conversation there. And then I also tell them, you know, the problem is even if you do everything right, like your baby is the best breastfeeding baby there ever was, and you had the best diet in the whole world, it's still not going to pass enough vitamin K to overcome the risk of a bleed in those first few weeks of life. It doesn't pass through very easily. And it's a vitamin that really makes a big difference. So I do try to emphasize that with them.
We talk a lot about cooking on the show, and for good reason. There's nothing more important to any medical professional than eating. Cribsiders listeners, today we're going to talk about Caraway cookware. Caraway cookware is beautiful ceramic cookware that's easy to use and looks fabulous in your kitchen. Honestly, I leave my cookware right on the stove just as an art piece. I love the ceramic's natural slick surface. All you need is minimal oil or butter and everything just slides right off the pan. Better yet, cleanup is super quick and that's a must have in our family. Not to mention that Caraway products are made without any toxic materials like PFAS, PTFE, PFOA, or any other very hard to pronounce chemicals. This cookware is loved by over 65,000 people, including us here at the Cribsiders. So listeners, it's time to try it for yourself by going to carawayhome.com/cribsiders to see all of our favorite products and the cookware we use to make cooking easy for even the most amateur home chefs. Plus, take an additional 10% off your next purchase. So this deal is exclusive for our listeners, so visit carawayhome.com/cribsiders or use code Cribsiders at checkout. Caraway, non-toxic cookware made modern.
You know, one question that we had like brought up when we were sort of talking about the script early on is, you know, it's been a while since I've done inpatient newborn, is having parents ask about some of the non-natural ingredients in vitamin K injection. Can you discuss that a little bit? Do people have hesitancy? Is there actual side effects from this?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is one of the most common reasons that parents will share with me about why they're worried about vitamin K. So first of all, as far as adverse reactions, I do tell them that, you know, a little minor localized bleeding or bruising can occur, as with any injection. So that's one of the things that I do share with them, because all, families don't want to hear like, oh, nothing ever happens, because that's honestly not true. But I do tell them that serious adverse reactions are extraordinarily rare in neonates. And then all the ingredients in vitamin K are really well studied and FDA approved. That's not the case for oral vitamin K. And when I say well studied, I tell them that like, this isn't a medicine that came out yesterday and we're trying to figure out what's going to happen in 50 years. This rolled out in the 60s. So it has been, and it's being given to every single baby born. So that means we have a lot of data to prove to you over the course of an entire lifetime that it is safe and hasn't resulted in any adverse outcomes to all these huge populations that have received it. And then when we get into the synthetics and preservatives, I do like to tell them, I cannot say this for every single vitamin K formulary out there, but the one at my hospital is preservative free. So if you're a hospitalist and you work with babies, I actually do suggest just talking to your pharmacy and seeing what type you have. A lot of times we can sidestep the whole issue of preservatives because we didn't know that our vitamin K didn't have preservatives to begin with. So it's really nice. And I've had a couple of families say that was their only hang up with the vitamin K injection. And as soon as they find out it's preservative free, they're on board with it, which is great.
So easy.
Yeah, so easy. those are my favorites. And I tell them, like, I looked at the ingredient sheet myself before my baby got her vitamin K injection. It's really great that you're curious to know exactly what is in there, and I'm happy to talk to you about it. There are a couple of other ingredients in the vitamin K injection. Sometimes there's a little a natural sorbitol or like a plant-based oleic acid that helps the vitamin K to dissolve. Sometimes there's a glycol element, but that's just to provide a little bit of viscosity. All these things they have been around forever. They're safe. They're most likely something you've already been exposed to a lot throughout your lifetime. It's been proven to be safe. There are likely fewer ingredients and preservatives in that little IM injection of vitamin K than there would be in any future treatment you might need because of a bleed. So that's something else that I like to tell them. It's a tiny dose.
It's a good comparison. I think we're going to start wrapping up our vitamin K discussion. Anything else you want our audience to know about or any suggestions?
Yeah, I think when I look back and consider all the reasons that I've heard about why families say know or are hesitant about vitamin K, it usually falls into one of three buckets. One is a concern for harm. So that's, you know, your pain with injection, concern for adverse reactions, the dose, the synthetics, the preservatives. So that's one bucket. The second bucket is usually something related to a desire to be natural, a belief that vitamin K is unnecessary or that any deficiency that does occur is expected. And then the third bucket is belief in some sort of alternative prophylactic measure, like an oral vitamin K or getting it through your diet. There's a lot of information out there where you can sort of already have in your head the main potential responses to those concerns. I think if you group them in one of those three buckets, it's easier to think about than worrying that you're going to walk into this room and hear one of a million things. It's usually one of something in one of those three areas. And you should always tailor your responses to what the family specific concern is, but already have in your head the common or good responses to the most common reasons. It's usually one of the three.
All right, well, maybe let's jump over to the hepatitis B vaccine, the other intervention we're talking about today. Can we maybe set the stage for this conversation by just talking about the risks of declining the Hep B vaccine and maybe some of the AAP guidance around it?
Yeah, so as most of us probably know, the hepatitis B vaccine given as a single dose after delivery and then with completion of the boosters during the first few months of life, prevents 70 to 95% of hepatitis B transmission to babies. About 800 newborns still become chronically infected each year from exposure at birth. And this is in the U.S. That happens from exposure at birth or during the first few months of life, exposure to either the mother or a close contact in the house. And chronic infection is pretty serious. That can lead to liver damage and liver cancer. It's fatal in about 25% of cases. So the AAP is pretty clear on its recommendations. They recommend that a universal hepatitis B vaccination should be given within the first 24 hours of life based on weight. Infants that are smaller, less than 2,000 grams, they should have their initial dose delayed until discharge or 1 month of age, whichever comes first.
So sort of like you had talked about sort of common reasons for refusal with the vitamin K, do you have similar buckets the way you think about in terms of refusal for a hepatitis B vaccine? And can you give us some examples?
Yeah. So the most common reason is that I hear is that a family doesn't feel they're at risk. The moms will tell me, well, I clearly had a negative test during this pregnancy, so why should my baby get this vaccine? That's my biggest bucket and the one that I run into the most when talking to these families. So I usually share with them that it's negative test during pregnancy is sort of a snapshot picture. And there's a couple of things that we have to think about to keep their baby safe when we get that snapshot. So that snapshot only tells us what their hepatitis B status is during that moment in their pregnancy. False negatives or miscommunicated test results are uncommon but possible. You know, and after you initially test negative, you can still become infected later by family members with undiagnosed infections or via contact with blood or body fluids or open sores from close contacts in the house. Those are potential risks and exposures to the baby that aren't related to having a clear test during your own pregnancy. Another common reason is that some parents think their baby is too young or that this vaccine will overload their immune system. I hear that a lot. I try to remind them that we give this vaccine has been around a very, very long time. We give this to little tiny preemie babies, and it's well tolerated. Side effects are really rare. The dose is very, very small, and it confers such an important bit of immunity to them. It doesn't overload their immune system. This is not a live vaccine. And honestly, I sometimes share with families that the number of antigens or just things in the world that their baby is exposed to, even on just leaving the hospital on the car ride home or just being in the house, is a lot more than what is in a single hepatitis B vaccine. But this does does confer immunity to a very, very harmful virus. If they have concerns about side effects from that vaccine specifically, I sometimes will share statistics with them. For your information, we know that between 2006 and 2017, there were 185 million doses of hepatitis B administered and only 160 significant complications from it out of those millions. So the rate is really, really small. Allergic reactions occur in roughly one out of every 600,000 cases, so very, very, very small risk. And some families have concerns that there are unsafe ingredients in it. And again, you should look at your pharmacy and see. Your hepatitis B formulary may have no preservatives. Ours is preservative-free, which comforts a lot of families. And again, any potential additives or buffers are old and have been around forever and well-studied.
Okay, so I, as you were discussing that, I had a couple of follow-up questions on some of these different reasons. So one of the things you mentioned is that hepatitis B is this really severe disease. Do you feel like, given this is often a more educated population, that people have a good understanding of what hepatitis B is and what the risks are?
I don't. I think people, again, it's sort of the vitamin K situation where I think families will tell you they understand risk. But this becomes some sort of vague, nebulous term where they're assessing risk as some harm that could just come to their baby, not really understanding the potential either severity, incidence, or chronicity of it. And I think those are things that you could share with them if that ends up being their root cause of it. But people tend to have a very poor understanding of risk to begin with. That's just how we are as humans. When given the option between doing nothing and doing something to prevent, doing nothing or accepting something they're unsure with to prevent a harm, most humans are much more likely to just go with do nothing. Because they're afraid of intervention, they're afraid of an uncertain intervention, medication, vaccination, whatever it is. And we've seen this over and over and over through the history of medicine, a hesitancy to adopt something new if we're not completely sure about it, and we would rather just take the risk of harm. That is a natural instinct. And so families need to know that, no, these risks are really real. They're really well documented. And here's why what the intervention we propose is not uncertain. And it's not this scary unknown that you're introducing something unnecessary or worrisome for your baby. This is recommended because we know the good it can do and the harms that it can prevent.
And to the point on the baby being too small, too young, this is something that I hear all the time is I'm going to delay this until they're older, till their immune system is more mature. What evidence, if any, do we have about the risk benefits of delaying hepatitis B until the 1 month or 2 month visit? And what evidence do we have about whether the families actually will go and get the vaccinations at their 1 or 2 month visit?
So I do not have a good statistic for you off the top of my head about cases of hepatitis B that have happened because of a delayed vaccination. Like instead of getting it at birth, they got it 2 months later. How many babies get hepatitis B during that time frame? I actually don't know. But I do hear that a lot, Sunine. That's actually a really common thing where parents will just say, oh, I'll just wait a couple of months. I don't really share facts with them. I've had a few change their minds, though, by approaching it a little bit more personally. And I just kind of tell them, well, to me, that's sort of like saying you're going to hold off on putting your baby in a car seat for a few weeks and do it later. You could, and it's really great that baby will be safe from the day you strap them in. But we have the ability to do that today. And that waiting period is just unnecessary risk, and we can really minimize that. And I think families have been more open to that approach than me trying to dig up some obscure study that probably has a very small number of patients they can even look at to say, this is how much you're increasing your window for hepatitis B exposure and transmission. And then here's of that number, how many babies actually suffered from chronic liver infection and cancer after that. So I think people are pretty open to hearing simpler answers about when they can provide protection and keep their baby healthy.
I love that way of explaining it. And I think it really makes things very simple and straightforward and how to really think about what their choice is actually doing. So that's fantastic. I'm totally stealing that.
Yeah, it's just like the vitamin K where the families say, you know, I do see a role for it. I want to do something, you know, when they say they're okay with their baby getting it at 2 months. And that's great. That's great. Let's talk about why we can do even better because I think our goals are very aligned.
Yeah, kicking the can down the road is actually not going to help the baby at all.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
It will, but
not until
it delays.
Point.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm.
I have one more follow-up question for your reasons for refusal. So one of the most common reasons I hear for people declining vaccines is concerns about side effects and safety. And I think you made a really good point that this isn't something new. There's a huge database. But I hear a lot of people say, well, vaccine complications are underreported, or we aren't looking in the right places. Have you heard that? And if so, do you have a response to it?
I tell them I have definitely heard that. That's the point, I think, where I sort of probe a little bit more. That's a much more complicated conversation because there is a lot of misinformation out there. We know that. And we can't quantify with certainty how many reactions aren't reported. It would only be if a patient were to have an encounter where they shared that with a healthcare professional. And that is something that I tell families. I'm like, you know what? That could happen. That could happen. But we have a lot more data on this than we do on a lot of newer things that come out. This isn't, I harp on the fact that this has been around. We administer millions of doses of the hepatitis B vaccine. If you're going to have to hang your hat on medicine, you choose the ones that you know the most and what you have the most reliable data on. And my job as their doctor is to pool the data that we have and make recommendations for their babies. And I would tell them that the research out there looks very, very definitive for the role of hepatitis B vaccine. There may be some fuzzy gray areas out there where a couple of cases or some end up not being reported by individuals, but that doesn't overturn the millions of cases that we have followed and studied for hepatitis B. And I also tell them very clearly that these are decisions that I've personally made for my baby after I've made a lot of research and a lot of thought goes into this. And it's not a random decision because we're trying to just inject more vaccines into people. A lot of times this comes down to, again, connecting with families and getting on a more personal level with them. A lot of families, when they talk about that approach or that concern, I find that it comes from a place of general fear about intervention in medicine. It's not about underreported side effects or this register that can't be relied on or not enough data. That's part of it, but a lot of the times it comes down to asking the families, if that's true, what have you heard? What are you worried about with this vaccine? And then helping them there. If they've heard something that's not true, to tell them, oh, you know, there's a lot of other data here that I have for you that shows that doesn't really happen. Or telling them that I have similar fears anytime my baby has to get an intervention, but here's why I made the decision that I did. And that seems to be much more effective in counseling them.
You know, as we start to wrap up this discussion, I'm so happy that you were able to spend all this time talking to us. You know, I have very intelligent parents who want to sort of just read more. You know, sometimes I just need to give them some time outside of, you know, what you've been able to explain to them so you can go back and talk to them some more. Are there any other resources, websites? Like, do you keep special books on hand, or are there pamphlets that your hospital system has to help educate the parents as they try to make these decisions?
So I do. My hospital provides families with a couple of pretty straightforward handouts. One comes from the AAP. It's the Healthy Children site that has a wonderful short bullet point handoff for families about the importance of vitamin K. And the CDC has a very similar outline for both hepatitis B and the vitamin K injection. Those are given out standard for all of our families that arrive on labor and delivery. I used to, when I first started out and wanted to information overload these families, give them a lot more. I find that the conversation is usually the piece that matters more. There was one family that did a lot of background research already. They came to me with the Denmark study that they had read about the efficacy of oral vitamin K regimens. And luckily, this was something that I had looked into deeply because of this is just an area of interest to me. And the family turned out that they didn't want to go through the paywall, so they only had the abstract. And so I gave them the whole article, and we went through it together about why the data was actually quite poor or not good enough to show efficacy of oral vitamin K. And after that, they were convinced. So again, I would say just tailor to your families. Yeah. I have been very lucky, I think, but also have worked very hard to increase my success rate the past couple of years. I'm happy to say that the last 7 families I've spoken to, I've had I'm 7 for 7 right now. I'm sure that'll change now that I've said it out loud, but I think one of the key parts to this recipe is forget about the papers, forget about the resources, and just listen to them, talk to them, connect with them. I like to start out with a shared goal to build trust as quickly as we can in this encounter, because they need to know that you're on the same team. And again, remember, we're starting behind the eight ball. They've already come in thinking about this. So one is come in, make a connection. 2, come in knowing the most common reasons for refusal of the vaccine, injection, whatever it is. Have little factoids, little easy numbers in your head that you can share with them for those more common reasons. But at the end of the day, listen to them. Find out the root cause for why they're hesitant, and approach with curiosity, not judgment, and empathize and validate. A lot of our motivational interviewing techniques that we've kind of gone through during this past hour, but ultimately it's about making a connection and building that trust between the patient and the doctor. I think that's what I love so much about my work as a hospitalist, specifically in the nursery. It's getting to build this connection with a family that is just embarking on parenthood on day one and getting to be a part of their team from day one. So I know I say we're starting behind the eight ball a lot of times with these encounters, but at the same time, do get to be there at a very special moment to make a really big difference. And I think that's something that we all really enjoy doing as hospitalists. And I hope that this talk will help some of us build those connections with more families.
That was just a really lovely recap of so many of the important parts from this. I hate to end on a down note, but let's say, I don't know, 75 patients from now, you finally have a family that says no again. What do you do if the family still says no?
Yeah, you know, that happens. Where I work, to get down to the nitty-gritty, if a family still says no after counseling, they have to sign some papers that specifically state they acknowledge the risks of declining vitamin K or hepatitis B, whatever intervention for their baby. And then we still go back every day and take the very best care of them. I think it's important to recognize that this very special therapeutic relationship isn't completely severed just because a patient doesn't agree with everything that we want for them. We don't write them off as difficult, and we support them still with their goals in the first few days of life in the nursery, and then we continue to build that trust and connection. In a small number of cases, just doing that and leaving those lines of communication open have resulted in families changing their mind the second, third conversation. Not always, but that sometimes happens, and it's all based on building better connection. Now, there's a grayer area about what to do if you're a pediatrician that takes care of well children later in life and choosing to still take care of families that may refuse all vaccines. That's a little bit more of a controversial area that I'll leave to the outpatient pediatricians to discuss, because I think that is much more of an ethical gray area when you're talking about trying to care for all of your other patients that may or may not be immunocompromised. But for us in the nursery, it's pretty clear what our counseling approach is and how we take care of the families until discharge.
Awesome. Well, it was fantastic. This was a really awesome episode. I think we learned so much more than just like, what are the recommendations? Why do we do this? But just how to like truthfully approach our parents, our families, how to be open, not to stigmatize them, but to be there, to how to develop relationships. And especially in a very short amount of time where you live in terms of from birth till discharge, I think we learned a lot, and I really want to thank you for all the time that you've given us tonight.
Thanks, guys. It was a pleasure to be here.
Do you have anything you'd like to plug before, give to our audience to check out before you leave us?
Yeah, the Pediatric Hospital Conference is coming up August 1st to the 4th in Minneapolis. I've gone every year since the end of my residency. I love it. It is 4 days of just incredible conference material related to all things hospital medicine, but also a lot of newborn medicine. And I'll be hosting a couple of workshops there. My colleagues will be hosting. It's 4 days of wonderful learning, meeting wonderful people, and it's a lot of fun. I think everyone should go.
Man, it's been a couple of years. Cribsiders did do PHM in mid-COVID. I remember we did a virtual version.
Yeah.
Maybe we need to show up in person. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, would love to have Cribsiders represent at PHM. That would be fantastic.
Well, maybe you can help us lead that up.
Happy to.
Well, thank you again. We appreciate the time you spent, and I have a feeling that we're going to hear a lot more from you in future Cribsider episodes.
I hope so too. I hope so too.
The new number is. This has been another episode of the Cribsiders.
It's for the kids.
Get show notes and sign up for our not quite weekly knowledge food formula feeds newsletter on our website at www.thecribsiders.com. We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback, so please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, or contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. A special thanks to our guest who contributed significantly to the content of this episode, Dr. Ha Nguyen, our showrunner Sam Mazur, and our wonderful social media team on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. I've been Sydney Engel.
And this has been Chris the Chimanchu. Thank you, and good night. And now, if you made it all the way to the end, you have your bonus, which is a poem written by AI. In this quiet room where new life softly lies, I bring words of wisdom under watchful skies. Dear parent, behold your child so small, requires more than love to grow strong and tall. Let us first speak of a foe, unseen but near, hepatitis B, which we must fear. With a simple vaccine given at birth, we shield your child, affirm their worth. And yet another guardian must take the stage to ensure their blood writes not a tragic page. Vitamin K, a mere whisper of a shot, prevents bleeding, a battle unfought. These first steps are small but mighty indeed, part of the journey planting safety's seed. Trust in these sciences as guides through the night to usher your child from shadow to light. Together as stewards of health we shall stand, guarding their passage through life's demand. Rest assured in these halls hope does reside. With each intervention their future we guide. See you guys.